Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The U.S. president secretly travels to Afghanistan. The next meeting between Israeli and Palestinian leaders will take place at the Vatican. I'm Ira Melman reporting from Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama has made a secret trip to Afghanistan to see American troops during the Memorial Day holiday weekend. The president landed at Bagram Air Force Airfield late Sunday. The White House says he's to be briefed by military commanders there and visit wounded service members at a base hospital. He is now addressing a gathering of troops.
I'm here on a single mission, and that is to thank you for your extraordinary service. I thank you as your commander-in-chief because you inspire me. Your willingness to serve, to step forward at a time of war and say, send me, is the reason the United States stays strong and free. Of all the honors that I have as serving as president, nothing matches serving as your commander-in-chief.
Some of the 32,000 Americans currently serving in Afghanistan are attending a rally with a performance by country music star Brad Paisley. You just heard part of that. International combat troops are set to complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by the end of this year. Some forces could remain in the country after December 2014 in a training and advisory role if Afghan leaders approve a bilateral security agreement with the United States. One exit poll shows that billionaire candy maker Petro Poroshenko won Ukraine's presidential election outright today in the first round, a vote that authorities hope would unify the fractured nation. Long lines snaked around polling stations in Kiev for the vote, but in Ukraine's troubled east, heavily armed pro-Russia rebels intimidated voters by smashing ballot boxes and blocking off voting centers. Sunday's ballot took place despite weeks of fighting in the sprawling eastern regions that form Ukraine's industrial heartland, where pro-Russia insurgents have seized government buildings, battled government troops, and vowed to disrupt the ballot. The exit poll for Sunday's election, conducted by three respected Ukrainian survey agencies, found that 48-year-old candy tycoon Poroshenko getting a 55.9% of the vote. In a distant second was former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko with 12.9%. Full results are expected to be announced Monday in the election that could be a critical step toward resolving Ukraine's crisis. A warning from Thailand's ruling military council as its patience apparently wears thin over demonstrations that have been growing in size and boldness. After 3 days of tense but mostly nonviolent confrontations between protesters and security forces, a spokesman for the ruling National Council for Peace and Order warns that officials may need to strictly enforce an army-imposed law that prohibits people from demonstrating against the coup. Sunday, protesters against the coup appeared to number as many as 2,000, growing from a few hundred on Friday. The warning came a day before the coup leader, Army Commander General Prayuth Chan-o-cha, was expected to receive the King's endorsement formalizing his status as head of government. Pope Francis has arrived in Israel after calling for peace in the region while visiting the West Bank. Francis flew to Tel Aviv by helicopter Sunday on the second day of his three-day Middle East visit. Speaking earlier in the West Bank town of Bethlehem, Francis said the time has come for everyone to find the courage to be generous and creative in ending a protracted conflict that has inflicted many wounds. He then invited Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli President Shimon Peres to come to the Vatican to pray for peace with him. Later, the Pope will preside over a joint prayer service with Orthodox Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, the site where Christians believe Jesus was crucified and buried. Two of three people killed Saturday by a gunman at a Jewish museum in Belgium were Israelis. An Israeli foreign ministry spokesman said Sunday the two were a Tel Aviv couple in their 50s who were visiting Brussels as tourists. Belgian officials say three people were killed in the attack. One suspect has been detained for questioning about the assault. Officials say a second person spotted walking from the scene is being sought for questioning in the shooting, which seriously injured a fourth person. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mboga.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
Lots of people think that Sisi is going to win these elections, but they are trying to support Hamdi in kind of to prove that we're here, we exist, we have a voice. We're going to vote to the opponent of Sisi.
After more than 3 years of turmoil, Egyptians go to the polls this week.
È giunto il momento per tutti di avere il coraggio.
He said the time has come for everyone to find the courage to be generous and creative in the service of the common good.
On his visit to the Holy Land, Pope Francis expressed his support for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Locally, we are just starting to understand or appreciate our own local artists and understand that, yes, they can be what you're wearing. You don't have to feel clothes are only made internationally.
And efforts to kickstart East Africa's fashion industry. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
After more than 3 years of turmoil, Egyptian voters are expected to elect their overwhelmingly popular former army chief, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, as the next president, hoping he'll bring stability and economic growth to the country. Some activists say the election that will take place on Monday and Tuesday is not real because the opposition has almost no chance of winning. Others say the opposition may not win, but a strong turnout by activists would emphasize their vision for the future of Egypt. Heather Maddock reports for VOA from Cairo.
There is no doubt in the Egyptian capital about Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's popularity. Firecrackers go off in an area once populated by Sisi's opponents as crowds and a parade of cars bearing Sisi's posters and Egyptian flags fill the streets. Young people dance in his honor. Sisi supporters say their man is most likely to end the insecurity and choking economic problems that have afflicted Egypt since the revolution in 2011. Ahmed, a driver whose taxi displays a Sisi poster, says it is his patriotic duty to support the former military chief's presidential campaign. But on the other side of town, supporters of opposition candidate Hamdine Sabahi say the election is far more complex than that and far from over. Mohammed Adam supports Sabahi.
Lots of people think that Sisi is going to win these elections, but they are trying to support Hamdine kind of to prove that we're here, we exist, we have a voice. We're going to vote to the opponent of Sisi.
Sabahi's supporters are not in the race to win. They want enough votes to make it clear to the government that Egyptians do not want to live under military control. Despite polls that show Sisi winning over 90% of the vote, activists say it is too soon to declare him the winner. Waving flags with the motto, "One of Us," Sabahi supporters say they do not want to choose between safety and bread. Other young Egyptians plan to ignore the election and boycott the vote altogether. Osama Malouk supports Masr al-Kawaya, a political party that attracts youth activists.
From the beginning, we told that we have a problem with the old environment, the election environment. It's been now controlled by the military.
Voter turnout has been declining in general in Egypt, at least in part because many people are tired of politics after at least 6 elections in 3 years. The authorities' crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood has also affected activist youth groups. By now, Malouk says many young Egyptians are simply despondent and uninterested in either voting or boycotting the election. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Cairo.
Meanwhile, Egypt's former army chief, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, is poised to win the presidential election set for Monday and Tuesday, with his sole opponent garnering only single-digit support. But as VOA's Elizabeth Out reports from Cairo, Sisi's once-overwhelming popularity appears to be waning.
Egyptian presidential frontrunner Abdel Fattah el-Sisi rode to prominence on a wave of popular support for his role in ousting previous president Mohamed Morsi. He claimed the support of millions of average Egyptians who applauded his crackdown on Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood and held him up not only as Morsi's replacement, but as the savior of the nation. Yet nearly a year later, the political divisions of the Morsi era have deepened. The economy continues to sink, and Sisi, despite the backing of the military and most of Egypt's media, appears more vulnerable. Even his supporters acknowledge popular resentment.
I thought, I love this man. Why not get a picture of him? So I got it, but every time I go up in a building, I come back to find the picture shredded.
Syed, who prepares and delivers the popular dish koshri on the streets of Cairo, remains a fan of the man he credits with keeping the revolution of 2011 on track. This despite Sisi's similarities to fellow military leader Hosni Mubarak, the target of that uprising. Syed is not alone. Sisi still pulls considerable support from women voters and others who pin their hopes on his promise of stability and eventual economic recovery. But the Sisi platform has been vague and his alienation of political opponents strong. Disillusionment with Egyptian politics and Sisi himself may keep some voters from the polls. Yet that doesn't mean they'll remain quiet forever, especially if basic needs are not met. Delivery man Syed, while counting on Sisi to lead well, has another take on the role of people power in making Egypt strong.
We need to work in order to make a living. We should not pray to God to send us dollars or gold. We need to work. We cannot sit at home and blame the economy.
Yet in a country with a long history of power concentrated in the presidency, it will likely still be up to Egypt's next leader to set the conditions for improvement. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
Pope Francis has visited Bethlehem in the West Bank on the second day of his three-day visit to the Holy Land. VOA's Scott Babb reports from our bureau in Jerusalem.
Pope Francis was welcomed Sunday to Bethlehem by the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, and senior religious officials. In his arrival remarks, he expressed support for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He said the time has come for everyone to find the courage to be generous and creative in the service of the common good. And he said to forge a peace based on the recognition on the part of everyone of two states of their right to exist and to enjoy peace and security within internationally recognized borders. Mr. Abbas welcomed the pontiff, saying Palestinians value highly his efforts on their behalf. He said, we have shown His Holiness the tragic situation that East Jerusalem is living and what he called Israel's plan to change its identity and status, to isolate its Palestinian residents, Christian and Muslim, to force them to emigrate. The leader of the Roman Catholic Church subsequently held Mass before several thousand people in Manger Square, near the site where Christians believe Jesus was born. Pope Francis arrived in Bethlehem after visiting Jordan. The pontiff prayed at the site on the Jordan River where many believe Jesus was baptized, and he met with refugees from the conflict in Syria.
E a nostra volta siamo profondamente toccati dai drammi.
He said he is very touched by the tragedies and pains that are especially provoked by the conflicts in the Middle East. He said he is thinking foremost of Syria, where a fight between brothers has lasted 3 years, produced many victims, and forced millions to become refugees. He called on all sides to return to the negotiating table. At a mass earlier in Amman, the pontiff called for religious tolerance in the Middle East and around the world. The Pope concludes his Middle East trip with a 24-hour visit to Israel, where he is to visit Jerusalem's Old City and meet with the head of the Greek Orthodox Church, Patriarch Bartholomew. The visit is to mark the 50th anniversary of a meeting between the two leaders' predecessors that ended centuries of conflict between their churches. The pontiff is also to meet separately with the Grand Mufti and the two chief rabbis of Jerusalem and to pay courtesy calls on the President and Prime Minister of Israel. He is to visit the Haram al-Sharif, Western Wall, and the Holocaust Museum before returning home Monday. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
The International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the government of Mozambique will co-host a regional conference this week titled Africa Rising. The conference aims to look at the economic successes and challenges in sub-Saharan Africa. Doris Ross is the IMF's mission chief for Mozambique. I reached her in Washington to find out more about the conference.
This is a major event that is to take stock of sub-Saharan Africa's strong economic performance and the ongoing challenges in the region. We will bring together policymakers from Africa and beyond, leaders from the private sector, civil society, academia, with the goal of exploring avenues to sustain the region's current growth performance and sharing the benefits widely among all populations. This event will also explore how to strengthen the partnership between the fund and its African member countries. We at the Fund see job creation that is anchored in private sector-led growth as a powerful link that could help the bridge between the wealthy and the poor by providing jobs and opportunities to earn income. We see the role as a government on one hand to provide an enabling environment for such private sector-led growth, but on the other hand, it is also there to provide public services such as infrastructure, education, and healthcare, and where needed, well-targeted transfers to the most vulnerable members of the population.
Now, growth can be seen as a relative term. How is growth measured when the population on the ground cannot quite see it happening?
You have a statistical measurement of growth, which looks at activities in various sectors of the economy and the value added, the income generated by those sectors, and that is aggregated in the gross domestic product, typically. But we also look at progress and growth through household surveys, and that is really a very rich source of information where roughly every 5 years, surveys are done in detail throughout the country on what are the income sources of the population and what do they spend on.
Doris Ross, the IMF's mission chief for Mozambique, she spoke with me by phone from Washington.
In East Africa, when it comes to locally made clothes, the region lags behind other regions, hamstrung by the ubiquity of cheap foreign-made cast-offs. But now the producers of New York Fashion Week are helping to kickstart East Africa's fashion industry through a series of runaway shows, arguing that the industry could create thousands of jobs, especially for women. Hilary Hula has more for VOA from Kampala.
Like hundreds of entrepreneurs in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, Emily Walusimbi is in the business of fashion. She sells clothes from a small shop on the side of the road where women of all ages come to look stylish.
They want to go with the trend. What they see in magazines, what they see on the net, that's what they want, not what their parents wear.
But all Walusimbi's clothes are secondhand, made in Europe. And the trends her customers want to follow come from Europe as well, she says.
If there's a new style in Europe, they get on the net, and so they say, I want that one.
Unlike in West or Southern Africa, East African women get almost all their fashion from Europe and America, says Ugandan fashion designer Gloria Wavamuno. Even local tailors shy away from creating their own designs, she says.
We tailor Western styles, so we copycat rather than innovate.
But this year, a group of producers and designers is hoping to kickstart a homegrown fashion industry they say would benefit the regional economy. Backstage at a recent Kampala fashion show, dozens of models and stylists put the final touches on flowing robes, chunky metallic jewelry, and African-patterned tunics. LDJ Productions, the producers of New York Fashion Week, are helping to stage a series of runway events throughout the region to showcase local designers and attract sponsorship. They're also planning workshops in business development, marketing, and social media. CEO Lori DeJong says the fashion industry can help with development by boosting commerce and creating jobs, especially for women.
In New York, we do Fashion Week in Lincoln Center twice a year. And just in the neighborhood that we do Fashion Week in, it brings in $82 million in revenue. So the potential here is enormous. And for women, there's not a huge amount of opportunity in the region, but fashion is just a great vehicle for women.
But, she says, East Africa has a long way to go.
It's nowhere near where it is in South Africa or Nigeria right now. They're probably about 4 to 5 steps behind. And I think it's just because it's such a new industry, the resources aren't here yet. And part of what we're helping to do is to assist in bringing in the right resources.
Attitudes are slowly starting to change, says Wavamuno, as East Africans come to see fashion as art.
I feel locally we are just starting to understand or appreciate our own local artists and understand that, yes, they can be what you're wearing. You don't have to feel clothes are only made internationally.
But with so many secondhand Western clothes available in markets and shops, some costing less than a dollar, building a business is an uphill battle. The solution, she says, may need to come from politicians.
Secondhand sounds reasonable because it's quick and it's cheap, but we need to now create a balance of it. And that also starts politically because we also need to then have our government controlling the amount of secondhand that come throughout our country.
DeJong and her team are partnering with the Regional Arts Association on a series of fashion weeks later this year in Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
Scientists are developing a vaccine against malaria that is designed to limit the illness in children who have been bitten by mosquitoes carrying the disease-causing organism. As VOA's Jessica Berman reports, they've discovered a protein that is essential for malaria parasites that cause severe illness.
With the protein, called SEA, the parasite is able to burst through infected red blood cells, ramping up disease symptoms. But malaria parasites deprived of SEA are trapped inside the cells, where they wither away and are eventually eliminated from the body by the spleen. Researchers at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, and Boston Children's Hospital in Massachusetts discovered the protein. Jonathan Curtis is director of the Center for International Health Research at Rhode Island Hospital and lead author of the study, which appears in the journal Science. Curtis says an experimental vaccine containing antibodies against the parasitic protein was developed and tested in mice. Rodents that received the vaccine were only mildly sick and had fewer parasites in their bodies than untreated mice. Next, Curtis says investigators measured levels of antibodies to the SEA protein in a group of 785 Tanzanian children.
And children with antibodies to our protein never got severe malaria. There were zero cases, as compared to children who did not have antibodies to our protein.
Researchers then analyzed blood samples collected in 1997 from 140 children in Kenya. Investigators found there were 50% fewer parasites in the serum of youngsters that produced antibodies to SEA during a high transmission season. As with the Tanzanian children, there were also no severe cases of the disease in children with antibodies against the protein, according to Curtis.
And so the thought is, by immunizing people with the SEA protein so that they make their own antibodies, they'll be protected.
The next step, Curtis says, is to test a laboratory-made SEA vaccine to see whether it works in primates. Curtis says he's excited that researchers may be on the verge of an effective drug that lessens the severity of a malaria infection, but he's also humbled.
Our eye has to be on the prize, and the prize is, you know, a child every 15 seconds. Just during this phone conversation, you know, dozens and dozens of children have died of malaria. It's just unbelievable.
If the vaccine proves to be safe and effective in monkeys within the next year, researchers expect they'll move quickly to human vaccine trials. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Modern-day ghost hunters in South Africa's Gauteng province are investigating a series of supernatural events. These include manifestations of plagueists and demons, but mostly concern the restless spirits of dead people. In the Gauteng Paranormal Society, or GPS, uses high-tech equipment to gather evidence of otherworldly entities. It describes ghosts as high-energy bundles and says it's able to measure the presence and power of spirits with electromagnetic field meters. For VOA, Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
People eat, drink, and are merry at a restaurant in Pretoria, blissfully unaware that it's apparently haunted by two ghosts that terrify staff members cleaning up after hours. GPS case manager Taryn Willifier says the group's currently investigating if one of the entities is the dark spirit of a man killed in a fight at the venue when it was a bar many years ago. She says such probes are what she lives for.
Overall, it's very exciting, especially if we get, you know, evidence or something happens and we get energy that actually responds to us. It's an adrenaline rush. It really is, yeah. Especially if it's an outdoor thing, not a residential one. That's the best, you know, the graveyards and that type of thing, yeah.
The paranormal experts have also spent a lot of time at an abandoned hospital east of Johannesburg. Willifier says they found something on an audio recording they made at the site that they've so far not been able to explain.
It was a very loud, like a man that took in his breath. He went and then he blew it out, like, he went like that, and it was very creepy, you know. I had to listen to it a few...
At a private residence, a woman reported objects constantly moving around, seemingly by themselves. During the GPS on-site investigation, Willifier made another random audio recording and later played it when analysing the collected data.
And we were chatting, and in the background I heard like a very faint whistle. And I played it back to the owner the next time we were there, and she said her father used to hum that tune. So that's how we knew.
The evidence was used to establish that the spirit of the homeowner's deceased father was active in the house. At another suburban property, Willifier says an unidentified entity would touch children inappropriately.
If there were any children coming into the home, friends, this spirit would try and attack them, so to speak, especially if it was girls.
She says this case remains unsolved. The GPS is looking into supposedly paranormal events at De Deer, south of Johannesburg, following an incident here a few years ago. According to Willifier, a local farmer's teenage daughter would often disobey him to go on late-night motorbike rides with her boyfriend. The farmer then decided to do something to scare the couple.
So he had taken barbed wire and put it around the tree. One tree span it over the road and to the other tree, just to knock them off of the motorcycle. But it, unfortunately, when they were driving past that and didn't see it, it actually decapitated both of them.
Since the deaths, says Willifier, there have been frequent reports of supernatural activity near De Deer.
If you are on that road in the evenings, you'll see a ball of light coming up to that area and then just vanish. And some of our team members have seen it. There are some of public that I know have seen it. We've tried, we didn't get anything.
Willifier is concerned that more people are contacting her to report very physical paranormal incidents.
Things that happened, like people being pressed down on beds, scratch marks, cupboards opening by themselves. A lot of the things that come in to me seems very violent.
In her experience, says Willifier, people who report coming under physical attack from entities have often dabbled in Satanism or have played games in which they personally tried to contact the dead, both of which she describes as extremely dangerous.
You are opening yourself up, because with those types of things, you don't contact ghosts. It's demonic entities that come through.
But Willifier emphasizes that she and her fellow investigators are not afraid of ghosts at all when compared with the other dangers they face in crime-ridden Gauteng province.
We actually laugh. Like, if we want to go to a graveyard, we're more afraid of being hijacked than seeing a ghost. You know? That's the truth.
She says the GPS plans to buy more and better equipment to expand its investigations as it continues its quest to capture solid evidence of the paranormal. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Pretoria.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
And still to come in the program, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, music from African Collection for your listening pleasure and relaxation.
And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
But first, Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go straight to Lagos and join Segun on the dot at EMA. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, May 25th. Let's kick off with African club football news. Ali Benghazi of Libya and Zamalek of Egypt grabbed their first wins in the group phase on Saturday to boost their chances in the Premier Continental Club Championship, the Champions League. Ali Benghazi beat Esperance of Tunisia 3-2 in a Group B fixture in Sfax, marking the second successive loss for the Tunisians in the mini-league stage. The result pushes Esperance further to the bottom of the standings after failing to pick a point from the two games so far. The defeat will increase pressure on Dutchman Ruud Krol and his players for a turnaround in the subsequent matches to remain in contention. And in Cairo, the Egyptian capital, Zamalek scored a 2-1 victory over Al Hilal of Sudan in their Group A clash. In the second-tier African Confederation Cup, Nkana FC of Zambia remains glued to the bottom of Group B, despite playing 1-1 with Sewe Sport of Ivory Coast in the mini-league series. Nkana, playing at home, managed to get a respectable scoreline, despite the sudden death of head coach Masauso Nwale in a car accident on Friday. The 51-year-old Nwale was driving to join his team at their training camp ahead of Saturday's match when the accident occurred. Before kickoff, a minute's silence was observed in memory of the coach. Adding to Nkana's misfortune, one of its players, Billy Nwanza, was sent off in the 80th minute for his second bookable offense. In the Confederation Cup's other match on Saturday, visiting AC Leopards of Congo played goalless with Ivorian club ASEC Mimosas in Group A. In more football news, Nigerian striker Shola Amiobi is to leave Newcastle United after 14 years with the English Premiership club. Amiobi's current contract will soon expire, and after discussions with club boss Alan Pardew, he has decided to bring down the curtain on his long spell at the club. The 32-year-old was handed his senior debut by Bobby Robson as a teenager, but often struggled to establish himself in the starting lineup, with a succession of managers preferring to use their own signings instead of the youth team product. Amiobi, whose younger brother Sammy remains a member of Newcastle's squad, made 397 senior appearances, 178 of them as a substitute, and scored 79 goals. His final appearance was memorable for all the wrong reasons, as he was sent off after earning two bookings for dissent during his side's 2-1 defeat at Liverpool. I have been at Newcastle United all my career and I've enjoyed every moment and always worn the famous shirt with pride. I'm now looking forward to starting a new chapter in my career, he says. In other news, Real Madrid has won the European Champions League for the 10th time. Extra time goals from Gareth Bale, Marcelo and Cristiano Ronaldo fetched the victory, as the team came from behind in dramatic circumstances to beat Atletico Madrid 4-1 in Lisbon on Saturday. Atletico seemed set for its first ever European crown as it led deep into stoppage time thanks to Diego Godin's first half header. But Sergio Ramos took the game into extra time with a towering header in the 93rd minute. Real Madrid coach Carlo Ancelotti, meanwhile, becomes the first man since Bob Paisley to win the competition 3 times. And now to our weekly 2014 FIFA World Cup tidbits. It is now just 2 weeks and 3 days to the kickoff of the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil, and the countdown is winding up.
Put your flags up in the sky, in the sky. And when we stand, 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 stand. Show the world where you're from, show where you're from. Show the world we are one.
That's the official song of the 2014 FIFA World Cup, entitled We Are One. As the World Cup approaches, protesters in Brazil seem to have become more energized. On Saturday, hundreds of demonstrators gathered in Sao Paulo in another protest against the World Cup. The Sao Paulo Police Department said on its Twitter page that no violent incidents had been reported and that over 250 protesters took part in the demonstration. After about 2 hours, the protesters marched down nearby streets, chanting, "There will be no World Cup." Protests over increases in bus and subway fares, government corruption, poor public services, and the billions of dollars spent to host the World Cup broke out last year in several cities. Protesters say the money would be better spent on improving Brazil's health, education, security, and infrastructure systems than on the soccer tournament. Several smaller protest rallies have taken place since then. The month-long tournament starts with the June 12th opener in Sao Paulo. Meanwhile, the 2014 World Cup is the most lucrative and expensive in FIFA history. Record numbers include $35 million in prize money to the winning team's federation, $4 billion in commercial revenue for FIFA, and a $14 billion bill for Brazil. With 3 million tickets available to buy, the 64-match tournament is almost sold out. The financial success, we have it, it is done, FIFA Secretary General Jerome Volpe has said, adding that FIFA has never sold so many tickets. Back here in Africa, Ghana, one of the 5 teams built to fly the continent's flag in Brazil, on Friday night gave local fans a glimpse of their firepower with a 6-1 beating of a local select side. Kwesi Appiah's team scored through Christian Atsu, Jordan Ayew, Albert Adoma, and Sule Muntari. The Black Stars coach took the opportunity to have a look at the depth of his squad ahead of his departure to the Netherlands on Saturday night to continue with preparations. The match ended the Black Stars' first phase of preparation for the World Cup. Ahead of the match, Ghana's president John Mahama hosted the national team to a dinner in the capital city of Accra. The president says the Black Stars have the quality to make history by winning the World Cup in Brazil for the first time. He urged the players to put extra effort to make that dream happen. Ghana, which will be making its third straight appearance at the World Cup finals, has been drawn into Group G with 3-time winner Germany, Portugal, and the United States. Ghana will train in the Netherlands until the end of the month and then move to Florida in the United States from June 1st to 9th before traveling to Brazil. In a related development, Cameroon, another of the 5 Brazil-bound African teams, will take on Moldova in a friendly in the capital city of Yaoundé on June 7th as part of its preparations for the World Cup finals. The friendly was initially planned between the Indomitable Lions and the Guatemala national team, but for unexplained reasons, the match was cancelled. And from the West African nation of Ivory Coast, which is also preparing for the World Cup, comes this bad news that Yaya Toure is receiving treatment in Qatar for an unspecified injury. According to the Ivorian Football Federation, Toure is the only member of the team to miss the start of the World Cup preparations in Dallas on Thursday. The midfielder will only fly to the US next Thursday to join up with his colleagues. Toure has suffered a thigh injury in mid-April, but returned after 2 weeks to help Manchester City secure the Premier League title. Ivory Coast will play 2 friendlies in the United States against Bosnia in St. Louis on May 30th and El Salvador in Dallas on June 4th. The team will arrive in Brazil on June 6th. At the World Cup, the Ivorians have been drawn in Group C against Colombia, Greece, and Japan. Finally, Landon Donovan, the United States' all-time leading scorer, has been left out of the 23-man squad named by Jürgen Klinsmann for the 2014 World Cup. Donovan, with 57 international goals, was among the 30 players who were taken into training camp. But the 32-year-old didn't make the final cut for what would have been his 4th World Cup. Donovan didn't figure prominently in the qualifying campaign, playing in just 3 of 10 matches in the final round after taking a nearly 4-month sabbatical from the game. The Americans will kick off their campaign on June 16 against Ghana. USA Soccer said the 23-man squad will be officially submitted to FIFA on the June 2nd deadline. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Umpuga in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Segun on the dot, Adeyemi will be back again next Sunday for another look at African sports right here on Nightline Africa.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is time for music from the continent. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. We'll be right back.
basanze mona bushalo nzongo basibatwe baba utsola baba rokalona ho nibeni shalo
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Here we go.
Good evening, Africa. When it was announced that President François Hollande of France had invited President Goodluck Jonathan of Nigeria and his African counterparts in the neighboring countries of Benin, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger to a summit meeting in Paris to tackle the profoundly disturbing abduction by the Islamist terrorist Boko Haram of nearly 300 boarding school Nigerian girls in the village of Chibok. A month ago, questions were raised as to why the African Continental Organization, the African Union, AU, did not take such an initiative instead of President Hollande. In the defense of the AU, it should be borne in mind that Nigeria had not previously shown any inclination to request or accept outside assistance in its over 5-year struggle with Boko Haram. In fact, critics of the Nigerian government have argued that the government itself may have given a low priority to the fight against Boko Haram. However, the manner of the abduction of the girls and the video display of some of them triggered an international outrage. In the circumstances, President Jonathan did issue a call for help to the United States, United Kingdom, and France. It was in that context that the President of France arranged the summit meeting. When the summit meeting convened, the representatives of the United States, United Kingdom, and the European Union were in attendance. AU representatives were not in attendance. Perhaps as a result of the summit, the President of Cameroon announced last Friday that his country and Chad had declared a war against Boko Haram and pledged that they will undertake all in their power to defeat the terrorist organization. Yesterday, President Goodluck Jonathan consulted with other African leaders that were present at the second inauguration of President Jacob Zuma in South Africa about the Boko Haram matter. This is not the first time that questions have been raised about the capacity and effectiveness of the AU in initiating critical moves. It was widely rumored that few years ago that South Africa was so disturbed by the absence of timely initiatives by the AU regarding the Libyan crisis that resulted in the death of Libyan leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, that it pushed for a change of leadership in the organization. However, since the change, there has been no radical departure from the past. It is worth recalling that when the African Union replaced the Organization of African Unity, OAU, it was trumpeted that the AU would be a more effective institution. But events have not confirmed this result. In fact, the OAU did accomplish a lot, and under the inspiring leadership of Dr. Salim Ahmed Salim of Tanzania, the OAU was both energetic and effective in tackling a number of acute crises in the continent. What is to be done now? Obviously, with respect to the Boko Haram crisis in Nigeria, the AU does not possess the technical possibilities in intelligence gathering and surveillance to make much of a difference. This is being done by the Western powers. But it could mobilize the members of the organization in solidarity with Nigeria. Going forward, the AU leadership should explore how best to position the AU to take timely initiatives. While the AU currently have a number of working groups, such as the Committee of the Wise Men or Wise Women, it could do more. For example, why not mobilize the enormous talents available in the continent to analyze and execute matters relating to the international and regional maintenance of peace and security? I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
And join us again on Saturday. I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nigeria is teaming with four neighboring nations to share intelligence and strengthen military cooperation to combat the threat posed to all of them by the militant terrorist group Boko Haram. The United States hails the agreement, struck at a summit meeting in Paris organized by French President François Hollande, as an important recognition that terrorism knows no borders and that nations working together will improve their chances in defeating a common foe. Under the pact, Nigeria, Cameroon, Niger, Chad, and Benin will develop a regional action plan for intelligence coordination, information and resource sharing, and border surveillance. Although Boko Haram operates primarily in northern Nigeria, the group has taken advantage of the region's porous and lightly guarded borders to conduct cross-border attacks and seek safe havens outside Nigeria. This trend was brought home on the eve of the conference when the group attacked a hydroelectric project being developed by a Chinese company in northern Cameroon. One Cameroonian soldier was killed and several Chinese workers are missing. Since 2009, when it began a campaign to overthrow the government of Nigeria and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law, Boko Haram has wreaked death and destruction across much of northern Nigeria. The group's insurgency has claimed the lives of more than 4,000 people and forced hundreds of thousands to flee their homes. At first targeting police and other government officials and facilities, Boko Haram has broadened its attacks to include churches, mosques, schools, media outlets, markets, and other civilian sites, leaving a trail of blood wherever it strikes. Last month, the group drew international outrage by kidnapping more than 200 young schoolgirls, offering them as hostages for Boko Haram fighters being held by the government and threatening to sell them. Undersecretary of State Wendy Sherman represented the United States at the summit in Paris and praised President Hollande for organizing it. Our government is engaged in the efforts to help safely recover the girls and improve regional security. We are providing surveillance aircraft and an interagency team of civilian, military, and law enforcement experts to advise Nigerian officials. Group action is critical not only to contain the threat and bring the captured girls home, but also to prevent these kinds of acts in the future and to promote development to address the underlying causes of violent extremism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.